Test, test.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. The Senate Education Committee is called to order. Senate File 510, Senator DeCrieff is the first on the agenda. Senator DeCrieff.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Before you is Senate File 510, which is basically related to education and allowing freshmen and sophomores to enroll in a college in the schools or otherwise more formally known as concurrent enrollment. This bill would open the college and the schools program to 9th and 10th grade students. Currently, it's only open to 11th and 12th grade students. And what this would essentially do is, if there's not enough students to fill the class of 11th and 12th graders, then 9th and 10th could also be allowed to take these classes to help fill the classes. It'll benefit the rural districts by providing more potential students with an interest in the classes. And we have a couple testifiers here today. The first is Cecilia Rotel with the Chamber of Commerce, and then we have Sue Henderson, who's the director of pre-college programs at the University of Minnesota, and she can provide more history and background on the program.
Ms. Rotel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Cecilia Rotel with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just to give you a little background on this bill, this summer we actually had a rural member contact us along with their superintendent and a couple of their principals bringing this to our attention. We didn't realize it was kind of a hole in the process where, you know, they don't have as many students as some of the more metro and suburban schools do. So they were offering these, you know, college in the classroom type of programs, and they would only get, you know, a certain number of students to take the classes, and then it didn't work for 11th and 12th graders, so they'd open it up to 9th and 10th graders. But as soon as those 9th or 10th graders signed up for the class, no one that was in the class was able to get credit. So it was the same curriculum, same class, but they just weren't getting credit for it anymore. So this is why the bill is structured in a way that after the 11th and 12th graders kind of have the first opportunity for it, it opens it up to 9th and 10th graders and allows for them to also get the credits.
So, Mr. Till, is it a provision in law that prohibits that credit granting if anybody else is sitting in a seat in the class?
Madam Chair, yes. That's what we're trying to fix with this. Go ahead.
Could you give your name for the record, please?
Yes, Madam Chairwoman. I'm Susan Henderson, Director of Pre-College Programs at the University of Minnesota. The legislation does state that 11th and 12th graders are eligible. It does not state in that legislation that if there are other students who are not registered for the post-secondary credit, that credit cannot be awarded to the students who are in 11th and 12th grade. So that varies. So in our program, we allow, for example, 25% of the students in any one class, that's university class that's offered through college and the schools, 25% can be non-registered students.
So, ma'am, I missed your name. I'm sorry.
Susan Henderson.
Henderson, Ms. Henderson. It doesn't negate the 11th and 12th graders' ability to take it
for
credit and post-secondary credit, but they cannot. The 9th and 10th graders cannot.
That's correct.
And this just adds that they can take it for high school credit, but can they take it for post-secondary credit then as well?
Currently, they cannot.
They cannot, and that has something to do with what the criteria is at the collegiate level.
Somebody have to correct me if I'm wrong, but the PSEO legislation, the 124D.09, stipulates that PSEO is open only to 11th and 12th graders.
Thank you. Are there other questions, or have I clouded the issue? Here. Ms. Rotel.
Madam Chair, I was just going to clarify what I think you were trying to understand is if there's 9th and 10th graders in the class, this would allow for them to get credit, whereas right now they can't, and even though they're taking the same curriculum. So we're just giving them what they already are earning.
Any questions? Is there anybody else who would like to testify one way or the other on this bill? Let's see.
Madam Chair.
Senator Daley.
If a ninth or tenth grader takes this course and gets, let's say, a C, and they want to have a high grade point average, are they required to have this count as college credit on their transcript if they, you know, once they go to college, or are they permitted to exclude that from their future college transcript, if, especially if the grade isn't quite what they wanted?
Ms. Henderson?
Okay. So the question is, if a ninth or tenth grader takes the course, if they're not registered for post-secondary credit, that will not be on a post-secondary transcript. If they are, it will be on a post-secondary transcript, and that goes with them.
Okay. Does the Senate Council have any other clarification? Are we, I think the understanding is clear here, or Ms. McQuay?
Madam Chair, Senator Nurlson, I think if the desire is to, much like how the University of Minnesota does it, if the desire is to make it so that 9th and 10th graders, if they are in the class, the 11th and 12th graders still get credit, we would probably put that in the stipulations of the agreement. And then if the if then it was the will of the committee to allow 9th and 10th graders to get credit, that's what this bill would do.
High school credit? Or
they would, Madam Chair, they would get post-secondary credit for this under this bill.
That would be allowed if it's...
Mm-hmm. Okay. Madam Chair, I have a further statement whenever it's appropriate.
It is appropriate, okay. Sanderson.
All right, Madam Chair and committee members. Post-secondary institutions that choose to sponsor concurrent enrollment programs and offer post-secondary courses in the high school do so with the understanding that it is the college or the university course that is being taught, not a version of the course that has been adapted to the maturity of younger students. Decisions about the appropriate grade level of students and other student qualifications must rest with the sponsoring post-secondary institution. That said, I can say that I do support the proposal to open concurrent enrollment courses to qualified 9th and 10th grade students. I strongly support the restriction of 9th and 10th grade student participation in PSEO only to courses offered in the high school. I do not support bringing them onto the college campus. So I think that's a really good start. I urge everyone, however, to be aware of the limitations on 9th and 10th grade students' participation. First, a student must have the appropriate academic preparation to qualify to take a college course, which means a high school's curriculum will have to provide 9th and 10th grade students with the requisite foundation courses before students will be eligible for the college level course. For example, the University of Minnesota's prerequisite requirement for taking calculus is 4 years of high school math, including trigonometry, or a qualifying score on a placement exam. Or, for example, in order to take the university's second-year Spanish course that's offered through college and the schools, students will need to have completed 3 or 4 years of Spanish study. So students will need to have the academic prerequisites. Second, social and emotional maturity and life experience are critical to effective college-level learning in some subject areas. Our University of Minnesota faculty who work with college and the schools already restrict participation in such courses, in these kinds of courses, for example, in a literature course and in a political science course. Our faculty have said those are open only to 12th graders. On the positive side, I can say that in other areas of study, maturity and life experience are not as critically important. For example, young students can readily and effectively learn subjects such as advanced mathematics and second and third languages. There's no problem. If the legislature deems 9th and 10th grade students to be eligible for concurrent enrollment courses, I anticipate that university faculty in the academic departments offering concurrent enrollment courses would open some college and schools courses to 9th through 12th graders. They would restrict some courses to juniors and seniors and continue to restrict a few to seniors only. Exceptions to these restrictions can be made on a case-by-case basis. I do believe that students, parents, and schools will welcome this greater degree of flexibility in the PSEO legislation, and college and schools is always happy and enthusiastic about serving students who have high academic goals and aspirations.
Thank you, Ms. Henderson. It seems to me, too, that one of the things that this does offer, when you have some uniquely academically gifted students, that they can continue to be challenged during these years rather than doing whatever or being bored or lose ground. And that, I think that's probably what I see as the main emphasis of lowering that option to the 9th and 10th grade. And presumably, what you've said, it seems that there are some other options. If some in some courses, you could actually, if you passed a test that showed you had accomplished that learning by whatever means, there would be approval at the college level for college and the schools type courses.
Right. Yes, the course, for example, we offer calculus right now. So students who meet those prerequisites, should this bill be passed, students in 9th and 10th grade who can meet those prerequisites would be eligible, and they could take the calculus course.
So, Ms. Henderson, but I said something a little different than that. Meeting prerequisites seems to be a course. What if they have accomplished that, whether it's self-taught or whatever else they might have done, that would enable them to take a test to determine that they have, would that also qualify them? You did in one circumstance acknowledge that. Is that a fairly common practice?
Well, both, certainly with math, if you earn a qualifying score on a placement test, you can register for calculus. The language departments also have placement tests.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Is there any further discussions? I think this could. Should we lay it on the table for further consideration, or could it just move?
Madam Chair,
Senator DeCray. Oh, Senator Wheeler.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to speak in support of it. I think college and schools is a great program. I've been out to the U a couple of times and seen it in action. I've seen it in the classroom. What I like is that the students can stay at their school, the mentoring, the teachers, how they're in service. It's just a win-win-win, and extending it to 9th and 10th grade is clearly the right direction. Thank you.
Would you like to have this go forward on its own, Senator DeCray?
I guess I would look, for your direction on it, Madam Chair. I feel that, this is a program that I don't think, would encapsulate, every 9th and 10th grader, in our school system. I think it takes a special 9th and 10th grade student to accomplish this. But for those special students, I think this is something that would be very valuable. But I would look to your direction.
Mr. Aronson finally decided that he wanted to testify. When I threatened to have some action taken on the bill, that got his attention. So thank you. Welcome, Mr. Aronson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Roger Aronson. I represent the elementary and the secondary school principals associations. And obviously, we've tracked PSEO and College in the Schools for a long time. And College in the Schools is a responsive program to PSEO where we attempt to keep the kids in the schools. I visited with some principals for today and just... I know you want me to be brief, Madam Chair, but I think that's kind of sneaky, yeah. just for the record.
It's getting out of control here. I'm sorry.
The downside of PSEO and College in the Schools is that there's a tremendous financial incentive to get these college credits, basically paid for. And what school principals have a concern about this is that you're going to try to drive then or give this financial incentive to 9th and 10th graders who are not ready for college classes. And what the principals say is that, you know, we're trying to teach these kids basically how to be in high school in 9th grade, that we have a good curriculum for them that we think is appropriate. And so when you open this up, some bad things will happen in terms of what classes they should be in. Anyway, I just want to put that on the record for you, Madam Chair. But the principals that I visited with about this were strongly resistant to expanding College in the Schools or PSEO to 9th and 10th grade students.
So Mr. Chair, this amends...
Your high potential.
This is the just amends the College in the Schools statute.
Correct.
And I think there are some controls. They aren't leaving the school. There's no guarantee. It's not clear that this is necessarily for college credit, but I think it opens the door for opportunity for challenge for gifted students. The principals would resist that, did you say?
Well, Madam Chair, in terms of phrasing the question to say, would principals resist challenges for gifted students? That'd be something else, and maybe that would be discussed differently. But this doesn't say for gifted students. This says that if there's space in these classes, the 9th and 10th graders can take them. And like I said, there's a significant financial incentive. We don't talk about it much, but College in the Schools and PSEO has money attached to it. I mean, they get credits at a very, very reduced rate. So there's a real push for some kids to do this. And it's been a very good program, you know, for a lot of kids. But the school principals think 9th graders and 10th graders are too young to be in these curricular offerings. This is supposed to be rigorous stuff. Now, there may be exceptional pieces on it, but by and large, that's their feeling on that.
Well, Mr. Aronson, were you here to hear Ms. Henderson's testimony?
I was here for part of it, then I was on the phone with some of my members out in the hall.
Oh, okay.
Sure.
So I think Ms. Henderson made it rather clear that the acceptance of 9th and 10th graders participation in these courses for college credit is not a given. There's a structure there that manages that I think should give you great comfort. Ms. Henderson, would you like to just reiterate that a bit? So,
yes. To put it short and sweet, I anticipate that if this change is made law, that it will benefit a small number of students in a small number of courses, because like all of our students, they have to meet certain qualifications. And I know right now that our university faculty, you know, the courses belong to the university academic department. There's certain kinds of courses they will not want 9th and 10th graders in, and there are certain courses that will be just fine. And the mathematics and world and classical languages are great examples of where students could, who are academically prepared properly, can take those and succeed.
So maybe one thing that we should, paying attention to the language here, if the understanding College and Schools is in other sections that's of the law makes it clear that the college does retain some control of the enrollees. If that's there, could you clarify that? So that it isn't just a matter of filling holes in a class or that type of thing, that there's more to it than that.
Right, that's correct, Madam Chair. Students must be qualified.
Senator Wieger?
Yes, Madam Chair, and you know, you're the expert, Ms. Henderson, but yes, this is rigorous. You have to qualify for it. And we've spent a lot of time talking about the achievement gap and trying to help those students that are struggling. And we've got to also focus on the gifted and who also face the struggle if they aren't challenged. This is the right direction.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Senator DeGrave.
I guess one of the reasons that I really liked this option is, you know, in some of the rural school districts where my children attended, my daughter was a gifted student but didn't have this opportunity in schools. And I want to see, especially these kids in the rural areas that are suffering some declining curriculum just to make expenses, I want to see those kids be challenged. So that's one of the reasons that I was willing to support this, and I would like to see it move forward.
Okay. Is there any further discussion or testimony? Senator Harrington.
Madam Chair, Senator DeGrieve, I apologize for coming in a bit tardily here. I was just concerned about transportation. My understanding of this is the students actually go to the college and take the classes there, or is this more like post-secondary educational option where the classes are offered in the high school or in the school itself?
Madam Chair and Senator Harrington, no, this is 9th and 10th graders staying in the school. I'm not in favor personally of seeing 9th and 10th graders go to the colleges. This would stay in the school.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator DeGrieve, would you like to move this to the floor? We could still have consideration.
Madam Chair, I would. I would move to have this go to the floor, Senate File 510.
Senator DeGrieve moves that Senate File 510 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor. Is there any further discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is passed to the floor. Thank you, Senator DeGrieve. Senator Nina, Senate File 388.
You're skinnier than I am.
I might add that the House, just as a little aside here while he's getting set up, the House had indicated some interest in moving bills separately and not just everything rolled in, but we haven't seen too many of those. And so I think that we should set an example of having some of those, but it doesn't mean that we may not include them in another fashion when we have supported them in an omnibus or a larger bill. I just wanted to add that clarification.
But vehicles.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I begin explaining this, I do have an A1 author's amendment. Is that being distributed right now?
It's the code.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Do you want to just describe, an author's amendment, we'll move to, but I'd rather have people at least be in possession of it before we vote.
Yes, absolutely, Madam Chair. Members, the bill before us is a bill that will, it does one thing. It gives educational options for students that are low income, that are in school environments that are where basically a large percentage of the students are not performing up to par, where we've got a large number that are essentially failing. What it would allow is for a portion of the education funding to follow the student into an environment where hopefully they could be successful. This targets families and children that are in a school for at least 1 year with family income of 175% of poverty or lower in a school that is defined as persistently low performing. And there are three criteria for that. One is that for reading, they are not able to pass at least bring up to standard 3 out of 4 on the MCAs for reading. For mathematics, they're not able to at least get 6 out of 10 up to standard on the MCAs, and this is one of the criteria I'll get was in the original bill. I just saw the A1 amendment myself, Madam Chair, and this is not a one-time event. So if this happens 1 year, that does not define a persistently low-performing school. This has to occur 3 years running. So by the time this option would be afforded to these families, this would be a long-term trend. So, for example, if we had a child in first grade, second grade, third grade, you would have a school where they're not able to get 3 out of 4 of those third graders, essentially. It's not grade specific, but they would not be able to have 3 out of 4 of those students up to standard on reading. In that event, then this would apply for those families that are 175% of poverty or lower. What would be afforded to that family then at that point in that circumstance is that they would be eligible for state money to follow that child into an educational environment where they would have other options. They could get out of a situation where there's a very high likelihood that these children would not be at standard, get into an educational situation that presumably, hopefully, would work better for them. They would get the equivalent of the statewide average of the state funding as defined. You see down on line 130, the state average general education revenue per pupil unit without transportation sparsity or the operating debt levy, et cetera. In the A1 amendment, we do define that they can only get an amount up to what the school is charging. So these students cannot come in bringing in more money to the school than what the school would be charging to any other student. So we're not creating a revenue source for many of these private schools are charging a lot less than what the statewide average is that the student would be eligible for. So we didn't want to allow for that. We've also backed off on some of the other requirements in the original bill to trade off for that, making this less expensive for everybody, saving the taxpayers money as well.
Senator Nino moves the A1 amendment, which is a delete all amendment that would put the bill in the shape that he would like to have us consider. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. So the motion prevails and that amendment is adopted. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, is the fiscal note included in our packet off of the original legislation or the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I did not get to that portion of the amendment yet. The fiscal note is based off of the original bill. We have in the A1 amendment, we've adjusted for that. Mr. Nauman can maybe go into this in some more detail. We've had conversations. Essentially, what was happening there is because the students would be eligible to receive the funding to follow them right away, but because of the education shift, the way we pay out, not necessarily the shift, but just the way we pay out money to schools, we would be putting up a little more money up front and then collecting it on the back end. So then in the fiscal note, you'll see there's a cost in year 1 and 2, then year 3 and 4 and beyond, you'll see significant savings. We've adjusted the language to account for that so that we don't have that cost in those first 2 years. If Mr. Nauman wants to explain that in more detail.
It's in this?
Nauman.
It's in his
memo. Madam Chair and members, Senator Nino and I have spoken about this on numerous occasions. I think he covered the waterfront on it. If there are questions, I'd be happy to address them.
So you have found a way that it does not have an upfront cost. Well, could you just clarify
Madam
that?
Chair, I'll be clear in saying that we think that this has adjusted the costs out of the bill. It's a dynamic where we are creating savings. Essentially, when you reduce a dollar out of the K-12 system, if you're at a 90-10 shift, you save 90 cents. And if you're in a 70-30 shift or something like that, you're going to save 70 cents on the first year that you make the reduction. So Senator Nino's bill pulls down and creates savings, but then it creates 100% spend. So that incongruity is what generates a cost on the front end, and then we grow into savings. So what Senator Nino's bill in section or amendment in section 2 does is essentially reduce it by 30% and then 15% in the first 2 years, and we think that will adjust out the cost. But we would, to be fair, we need to actually formally have this discussion to ensure that we have.
Okay. Is there any discussion or any questions right now for clarification on the bill? If not, I believe there's some folks that would like to testify.
Yes, and Madam Chair, we do have Mr. Bartholomew of the partnership had some students that were going to testify when this hearing was held for the other body. They weren't able to do that, but they did record a video, which I understand is available. If we can play that right now, I believe that
Fine.
Would be good.
Is there somebody that can run the machine here?
Yeah. I can't see it, so.
If you would like to and you haven't, you're welcome to.
Eastern Rim, Jenner High School. I work at Dorsey Winnie as a child department
to that high school, I've been like thinking that, oh, I'm not going to go graduate, not going to go to college, but 4 years forward, now throughout the 4 years, I've learned that it is possible with the support that all the teachers give us. They mean a lot, and they tell us that you can make it. Just that support helps us make it to the very end of our 4 years.
Hi, my name is Daria Garnison, and I work at Dorsey and Whitney Law Firm, which I've been there for 4 years. What Kristen Ray has done for me is to tame my attitude. You know, I used to always get into arguments and fights. You know, I really didn't care. So if I would have went to a public school, I would have been careless, you know. I wouldn't care about my future. But Krista Ray has teachers that are motivated to, you know, inspire us to become somebody. They're loving. They're always there just to have someone just to touch your shoulder and be like, you know what, I'm here for you. And that, you know, really blossomed me, and it made me really happy. And, you know, Krista Ray is like a glass of water. It's like refreshing. Like, it feels good. It feels right. And I just love Krista Ray. It's making me become a more mature woman that I'm going to be in the future.
I'm a junior at Krista Ray Jesuit High School. I work in the front desk of Krista Ray as a receptionist. Coming to Krista Ray from a public school was a big change for me, since in public schools I really didn't pay attention, and because there was just too much drama in the school that you couldn't actually focus in class, and you were just around kids that didn't want to be there. And I think if I would have been to a public high school, I would have been around people like encouraging me to do bad things, and like just being with students that don't even want to be there. And in Krista Ray, it's a different environment because all the students actually try hard. It's a learning community. And I really like it because till this day, I hadn't like failed anything in Krista Ray. Like, I passed all my classes, and in middle school, it was very, very different because the teachers wouldn't like pay attention to me or anything. And now I'm thinking of college, which I didn't think about when I was in middle school. And my main goal would be to, since I started Krista Ray, my main goal always was to be like a politician, because there's so many things that I would like to change, but I have to start from the bottom, of course. And I'm thinking of going to colleges, so next year I'm gonna start as a senior applying. Hopefully I get to it, because it's my goal to graduate from high school and move on to college.
I think that every parent and most teenagers won't admit, but we need structure. We need structure. We need guidelines. We need the extra attention. It's critical years of a teenager's life, from ninth grade to graduation. We need someone that's going to sit on our shoulder and say, did you get your homework done? In public schools, I feel maybe they're overpopulated. The teacher-to-student ratio is not okay. Students aren't getting the one-on-one they need. Therefore, they're sitting in the back of the class and they're receiving Fs. And our money is going down the drain. And that's what makes me angry personally.
Would you want to take that risk?
I think that Krista Ray, the first graduating class of Krista Ray of this year, that's important because a lot of us are going to graduate. At a public school, when you look at their percents, it's not as high as it should be. And so I feel like you need the structure to be able to graduate. And at public schools, the students, like, I'm going to piggyback off what she said, like, they don't come to school to learn. They come to school to see who got the best outfit on, or to see what dude they can get with, or, you know, it's not about education at public schools as a whole. At Krista Ray as a whole, we want to learn. We want to get the education. We want to better ourselves.
On the public school side, it's more money is their motivator. But for us, at least at Krista Ray, Jesuit High School, Twin Cities. education is our motivator. Education and the environment we're in is our motivator to go to college and succeed. The people we're around, the teachers who teach us, and our motto, a school that works.
Like, the thing is, the most important thing is it that we had the choice to come here. It's not really we had the choice, but our parents had the opportunity to send us here. And that's the most important thing, because I could have ended up going to public schools just like all my other brothers and sisters, and I could have ended up just like all my brothers and sisters, working minimal jobs, you know, supporting families. And now I have, you know, a great opportunity to go to college, you know, do what I want, follow the things that I want to do, not having to settle with the meaningless job that it's never going to take me anywhere. And choice is the most important thing, because if a kid chooses to go to that school, it's because they want to go to that school and they know that they can succeed at that school. So if it's possible for us to give those kids those means, then why should we deny them that? Why should we deny them their choice or their parents' choices to where this kid can succeed and he can do something productive in our community, instead of becoming another statistic of, you know, getting shot, being a drug dealer, going to prison, or, you know, just being nobody when we can make them into somebody.
How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I am the youngest of 15.
And where are your brothers and sisters?
I have a couple of brothers out of the country. Some of them live in Mexico. I have one brother who lives in Arizona, and most of them live here throughout Minnesota. I will be one of the first to graduate on time, and I will be the first to attend a four-year university.
Thank you, Senator Nito.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have some people that would like to testify, and if we want to have them come up to the table, just a couple of more comments here while they're coming up to the table to speak. Two of the larger examples of a program similar to this were in Florida, and we heard a lot of testimony about the good things that happened in Florida and also in the Milwaukee public school systems. And so this is not unprecedented. There's been a number of studies, I believe 10 studies in total on those two circumstances. And the studies found that not only did the students who participated in a opportunity like this, not only did the students do better by being able to come out of that environment where students, many of the students were not passing or performing up to standard, not only did those students do better in aggregate, but the schools themselves brought up the performance overall. And in the case of Florida, Florida Supreme Court, this operated for a period of time, and the Florida Supreme Court ruled in their particular state that it was not upheld under their constitution. What was interesting, in the state of Florida, those schools that were on the cusp of being entered into a program like this where students would be given the option, those schools started to improve their performance. After this was struck down in Florida, the performance of those schools degraded. So this is a great incentive for schools to perform better and certainly help students to perform better.
Thank you. So Mr. Knoll?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Pete Knoll. I'm Education Director, Minnesota Catholic Conference, and we stand in support of Senate File 388, and we want to thank the chief author for offering this bill and the A1 amendment as well that alleviates some concerns that we had, some small concerns that we had with the overall bill. But we think this is a wonderful opportunity to expand school choice options, particularly for disadvantaged children who find themselves, through no fault of their own, in a situation where they're in a low-performing school, one that's persistently not done well by them. We think that this is a real removes a real barrier for them and provides yet another option, a quality option, that they can choose if it seems like the right fit for them. Most of our non-public schools actually in Minnesota are accredited schools, so I just want to reassure everyone that they go through a very rigorous process, cyclical process that requires them to go through a self-study process, a very in-depth self-study process. There are 9 quality standards and performance indicators that they must comply with in order to become an accredited school, and this is through the non-public Education Council, which is statutorily provided and advisory to the Commissioner of Education. And so that's kind of a reassurance of quality within our non-public schools in Minnesota. So with that, Madam Chair, I would stand for any questions that members might have of me.
Are there any questions of Mr. Knoll? If not, the next one is Mr. Bartholomew.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I knew I shouldn't have fucked around with that, but thank you. We'd like to thank Senator Nenow for bringing this bill forward, and we'd ask that you'd support this as a key element of school reform. I suspect in a little bit you're going to hear about how this bill, in passing it, would do terrible harm to Minnesota's schools. We hope to show that just the opposite is true, that Senate File 388, as Senator Nenow alluded to, will not only help students, but schools and the state as a whole. Twice before, in 2006 and in 2000, the legislature heard proposals similar to this. We were convinced then that providing this option for low-income families was not only a strategy for improving the education of the kids who participated, but also a strategy for helping to improve the overall public education system. The earlier research at the time backed this up. Unfortunately, there were concerns that this would negatively impact public schools and hinder our efforts to close the achievement gap, so they were never adopted. It's now been 11 years since a version of this bill was first heard, and while there are a number of factors, Minnesota has one of the worst achievement gaps in the country. In addition, over those 11 years, there's been a growing body of research that continues to show that both the participating students and the public schools benefit from expanded choice. In fact, there are now at least 18 scholarship programs operating in the U.S. And just for context, I'd like to reiterate what Senator Nenow mentioned in terms of the criteria in the bill. Not only are the student performance levels set at a rate that is pretty unfortunate, but it has to occur for 3 consecutive years in a row. So it's not just 1 or 2 years. There's a clear pattern. Looking at some of the research, and if ever anybody wants some great weekend reading material, I have a little bit of it. Do students that participate benefit from these programs? Most of the conversations and research on school choice generally concede, but for the kids that make the choice, yeah, they benefit. In fact, when Jay Green was here a couple weeks ago, he referred us to a number of other studies that we hadn't been aware of earlier. And of the 10 random assignment studies on the impact of scholarships, 6 of them concluded that all groups of students experienced reading or math gains and or increased their likelihood of graduation. 3 studies found that at least one important subgroup of students experienced achievement gains and no subgroup was harmed. And only 1 study found no achievement gains. In all, it's pretty clear the participating students benefit. And I think the video you saw is another example of that. Another question that comes up a lot is, do choice programs cream the crop of students, leaving behind only the most challenged students? The U.S. General Accounting Office did a study specifically on this in the Milwaukee and Cleveland scholarship programs. They found that in both Cleveland and Milwaukee, scholarship students were more likely than public school students to come from families that had less income, were headed by a single or unmarried parent, and that the mother was more likely to have completed high school. In Milwaukee, the GAO found that participating non-public schools attracted lower performing public school students. Do scholarship programs help public schools that eligible students attend? And this is really a key question. Again, there's a growing number of studies on this critical question. One that we've highlighted was done by a Harvard economist, Dr. Carolyn Hoxby, and she looked at four broad categories of choice. Inter-district choice, the availability of non-public schools within a district, the availability of charter schools, and then the scholarship program in Milwaukee specifically. Dr. Hoxby, and this has been reflected in other studies, found that in each of the above scenarios, once a certain percentage of students, between about 4 and 6%, begin to be attracted to one of the available choices, the host public school not only improves its efficiency, but also student achievement. In fact, those schools in Milwaukee that had the most students eligible to use a scholarship improved the most. And I think most of the research, again, just kind of indicates that once a school realizes that there's a percentage of kids that are starting to leave, they begin to ask why and what can we do differently to keep them and prosper ourselves. Dr. Green, again, referred us to a number of studies on does choice impact public schools. And we went through those, and I'll just quickly highlight the conclusions of one of them. The bottom line is that none of the studies of systemic effects from voucher programs find negative effects on student achievement in public schools. The bulk of the evidence supports the conclusion that expanding competition improves student achievement. And while one shouldn't conclusively claim scholarship programs will solve all our concerns, there is ample evidence to show that they do make a positive impact. Scholarship programs are being increasingly used by other states as a school improvement strategy and for closing the achievement gaps, and the growing body of research consistently backs this up as being successful. In closing, again, I just want to reiterate how low student performance levels need to be under this bill for three consecutive years. And given that the research is telling us, why wouldn't we use a limited scholarship program for low-income families? It's been 11 years since this was first heard, and while a lot has happened over that time, Minnesota still has one of the country's largest achievement gaps. Senate File 388 is one reasoned strategy for helping to improve student achievement. And apologize for the long testimony, but I wanted to get out there because I know you're going to hear that this is going to somehow damage our public education system. And quite frankly, research shows that that's not the case. The opposite is actually true. And even if you wanted to cite a number of the other studies and you conclude that the research is mixed on this topic, again, we have one of the worst achievement gaps in this country, largely for low-income and non-white students. We would argue that we're to a point where this is a sensible approach on a limited basis, and we've been doing a lot of things over these last 11 years and not this, and yet we've made no gains on we're still one of the worst achievement gaps in the country, and we'd argue this is a very sensible approach to take on a limited basis. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. We have a couple more. I don't know who wants to come next. I think Dr. Ephraim is listed, and Tom Pritchard and Jim Grathwall. Votes. Mr. Pritchard.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we want to speak in strong support of this bill. For a couple reasons. One is already mentioned, I think, competition and I think incentives for existing schools. But I think most importantly, I think it empowers parents and students. Parents are the primary educator of their children, and I think what this bill does is really puts the resources in their hands and the ability to make decisions which are in the best interest of their children. And we think that's very important. Parents play the primary role in the educating of their children, and I think this only empowers them to be more involved, and especially low-income parents. We also think the bill provides accountability in terms of use of norm reference tests so that students and their parents can see how their children are doing on the basics. So we support that, and we also feel that it doesn't extend regulations overly broad into the private schools. So, and we think that's very important as well. So we want to speak strongly in support of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Ephraim?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of Education Liberty Watch, and I won't speak long because Mr. Pritchard pretty much said what I wanted to say. We do support the bill, and we thank Senator Nino for doing this, for giving parents a choice, and for being mindful of the potential for overregulation of the private schools, and feel that this bill strikes an excellent, excellent balance and still gives the accountability through the testing mechanism as it's written. Thank you.
Thank you. If there's any questions you have of the testifiers, Mr. Graswell?
Thanks so much. Madam Chair and members, my name is Jim Graffball. I represent the Minneapolis Public Schools, and I'm going to disappoint Jim Bartholomew, and I'm not going to predict the end of the republic or the demise of public education because of the presence of this bill. And I really want to thank the senator for bringing the bill forward, because I think it's good and important for us to have a debate about the difference between public education and private education. I think with new members around the table, that's an important and healthy debate to have. And I'll disclose I'm the product of both, and I think I benefited by that. And Minneapolis Public Schools, we're a strong proponent of public school choice, and I'm here to testify in opposition to the bill, because I want to distinguish between public school choice and private school choice, and I want you to consider carefully the difference between state resources for, I think you do empower parents in public school choice, and I just want to distinguish for you, you empower private schools in to choose who they will enroll. So first, a little background. Minneapolis Public Schools is a strong proponent of public school choice. 34,000 pupils, more or less, it depends on how you count the kids, choose Minneapolis Public Schools each year. In the city of Minneapolis, 9,000 pupils, residents of Minneapolis, choose charters. Our administration and school board are working cooperatively and recruiting more charters to work with us and serve our students. In the city of Minneapolis, 2,200 open enroll out through Choice Is Yours or other means. About 600 to 800 annually open enroll in. So we live in the land of 10,000 choices, and again, public school choice actually really does support our students. And the distinction is, in public school choice, students and families choose the school they want to go to. In private school choice, it's the schools that choose which families they want to serve. Now, I to distinguish that a little bit more, if a student comes to us with physical or other health impairments, we say, welcome aboard, we can serve you. If they come to us with any one of about 90 languages, we say, welcome aboard, we can serve you. If you are homeless or highly mobile, we have 3,888 students at the last count that are homeless, highly mobile. And, you know, figure the math on a 34,000 student base, that's about 12% of our students are homeless or highly mobile. I think we have a great and strong tradition of private education in this state and in this country, and I have a certain debt to it. But in my experience in private education, it wasn't the homeless and highly mobile who were first served. It wasn't the physical or other health impairment students. We have 20% of our students are special ed. And then I want to meet Senator Ninau's offer and raise it, because under No Child Left Behind, we have what we call NCLB choice, which is if after 2 years, not three, and you're under the NCLB definition, that's persistently low performing, you have the opportunity to enroll in a higher performing school. In Minneapolis, 22,500 kids, that's where that number comes from, 22,500 kids are eligible for that NCLB choice to open enroll or to enroll into a higher performing school site. We had In the last year, 23 parental inquiries, 11 students enrolled. I raised that or moved their school under that specific provision just to let you know, I think we have a lot of choice. I think you want to consider the constitutional questions involved. I'm not a legal or constitutional scholar, so I'll leave that to other people. I appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion with you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Cathrell. Are there any questions of members of any of the witnesses that have been before us? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question for the author, actually a couple of questions, which relate to the final sentence that Mr. Rathwell just addressed, and is the legal and constitutional aspects of this. And I was not as concerned until I watched the video of Cristo Rey, which is a school that I know quite well. I go to do public speaking to that school almost every year, so I'm very familiar with it. And for the record, I'm a practicing Catholic, so I do know about these schools quite well. But I am concerned, Senator Nino, about kind of the issue of separation of church and state and how kind of the examples that you bring before us are actually religious schools. They are parochial schools. And I wonder if you have thought about it and how do you plan to account for that?
Senator Nino.
Madam Chair, actually, members, there's a handout at your place with relevant case law as to the constitutionality, and I would say that's your best resource. Short answer is that there is, right now we do have money flowing, following students into similar circumstances, into environments where they do offer religious programming under some open enrollment into private religious colleges, things like that. The constitutionality is not greatly in question. There's relevant case law that would indicate that this certainly would be upheld.
Thank you, Senator Nino. I do believe, Madam Chair, that this is an issue that I would like to have a review on, because I think clearly, especially bringing the examples that we brought today with the video and everything, there is a question before us as to how we will use these dollars. And the second question, Senator Nino, the tuition in Cristo Rey, which is a very, really a school that offers a very modest tuition, I think, is $11,000. And that does not include uniforms and texts and access to technology and all sorts of fees that they have to ask. And so I'm not very current with the numbers, but I think we have about 7,000 per pupil, and if we have ELL, we have three counts of 700. Child with disability, I know for a fact that many private schools will not consider bringing a child with a disability because they are not equipped to really deal with that. So that brings us to about an average of 7,000 to 9,000, really, if we're generous with our funding. And you state in the legislation that these are families that are less than 175% of federal poverty level for eligibility. So what are they supposed to do for the $5,000 for one of the cheapest parochial schools? Now, if we take Blake, that's $20,000. And that's for grades, I don't remember, but I think it's $27,000 for seniors. So it's quite significant, the difference, for very good schools. So I wonder how do we account for that? What do we do about that?
Well, Madam Chair, if the Catholic Conference wants to talk about what their typical tuition is, they could give you some real numbers probably. The average tuition is not for private schools is not anywhere near $11,000. Certainly not anywhere even in the same galaxy as Breck or some of those schools. You're looking well within the dollar figures we're talking here in this bill. And in my particular circumstance, I whispered during your testimony, I'm a product of both private and public school. Actually, I should say public first, because I went through public school through 10 of my years, and I finished out my last few years in a private school in Isanti County. And in today's dollars, my guess would be the tuition is probably something like $500 or $600 a month, which is well within the dollar figures we're talking here. But if you want to give us some real life numbers.
Certainly.
Mr. Knoll.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Torres-Ray, specific to your question, and Senator Nino is quite accurate there on the $500 a month, because average tuition elementary school is right around $4,500. Now, high school would be a larger amount than that, probably in range from $11,000 to maybe, higher than that. I'm not sure what the highest might be. But also, I want to mention that all of our schools offer some assistance as well to families. And once a family is matriculated into the school, they're eligible for all of those reductions in tuition as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just I pull out the number from the website. So it says
sure.
11,000. So that's how I came up with the number. So
sure.
It's roughly there. I think probably a little bit less for elementary and a
yes.
little bit more for
yes.
high school. But it says 11,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I was curious about how do we come up with the rest of the money. Thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, Senator Nino. Do we know how many families are we talking about here with this less than 175% national poverty?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know that we know exactly the fiscal note you have in front of you. I believe assumed 1,000 families a year. That's the best I can give you for hard numbers.
Senator Steven?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, I was just wondering if you could clarify what the differences were in the original bill you introduced and the lead-all, because I think I heard Dr. Ephraim reference that some issues were taken out of your lead-all, and I'm wondering if it has to do with, if I'm looking at the, I'm looking at the House file, sorry. There was something about in the House file, anti-discrimination, harassment, and violence prevention. Was that ever in your original bill? Policies that the private schools needed to have adopted?
I don't know what's in the House file. I know the House file did adopt several amendments, something along those lines. I don't think any of that was ever in the original bill. There were some, and this I touched on this when I talked about changing or limiting the amount that we pay so that we're not bringing through 7,500 is kind of the ballpark figure that we were using when we estimated the average statewide amount. So they weren't bringing through $7,500 for a child, allowing the school to charge or having the school charge $7,500 because they can, when really their cost or their normal tuition anyway is maybe $5,000 or $4,500 or $6,000. And the trade-off of that was eliminating some of the mandated compliance of various statutes, sections of statute. Let me find the right section here. I'm looking at the bill as introduced. I believe it was subdivision 2 there, and I don't know specifically what Dr. Ephraim's concerns were that she talked about here. I was kind of reading while she was talking, so I don't know if she specified that. Subdivision 2, I believe that section is no longer in the A1 amendment, section 120A04, chapter 363A. There also was accepting students on a random basis. I believe that there was some concern about would that create problems for some schools to not be eligible to participate with various special needs of some sort. That was one mandate that was relieved in the trade-off in not offering that higher reimbursement out to the parent. That's off the top of my head, that's what I recall we changed mostly other than the financials.
Madam Chair.
Senator Zeeben.
Just to follow up, perhaps we could get I could get council's help with what sections 120A04 and 121A03, I think it is, that were referenced
and if
before. It seems to me like it looks like the Americans with Disabilities Act and then something about adopting an anti-discrimination, harassment, and violence prevention policy. And Senator Nienau, you may not be surprised, but I have other concerns with your bill besides this. But I would think at the very least that we would want to ensure that if we are sending public taxpayer money to private schools, we would want those private schools to comply with things that the state legislature and state has already decided are important for to have in our public schools, things like bullying prevention policies and compliance with ADA. I mean, obviously, private schools probably have to comply with that. But, Council, if you could clarify what was in those sections of the statutes, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Yonker?
Madam Chair, members, 121A03 is the model policy for sexual, religious, and racial harassment and violence. And then 121A.04 is the athletic program sex discrimination section.
Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair, thank you. Council and Senator Nienau, could you just comment on whether you'd be amenable to accepting to putting that type of language back into your delete all?
Madam Chair, the 121A03 was, I don't believe, ever in the original. 121A04 had to do with athletics, and that was, as I recall, and bear with me, these conversations were happening at 11:30 last night. As I recall, there was some concern about the smaller schools and can they offer, in every circumstance, comparable programs if you have maybe only two female students? How do you offer a team sport? Things like that. That was, I believe, the conversation around 121A04. And if we were allowing them to bring over extra money, a couple $1,000s per student, maybe they might be able to do that. But that was part of the trade-off in putting in that capitation on not charging more than what they do now.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, Senator Nienau, I misspoke. The 121A.0695 was in the original House file, it looks like, in the first engrossment of the House file version. So that's where that's coming from. Again, I still have a lot of concerns with your bill, but at the very least, I would think that this would be the type of language regarding bullying and anti-harassment legislation that didn't address the athletic concerns, but certainly would probably need to be, I would think we would want to adopt to ensure that the private schools are consistent with where our state taxpayer dollars are going in our public schools.
Senator Nienau, it's
was that a question? I don't know
if it's
no, it wasn't a question.
Yeah, it was
I was
a
just
statement.
Saying it's a
yes.
concern.
Great.
The bill moves forward if
Thank
it
you.
Does.
Is there any further discussion? This bill does have financial implications, so it cannot go on its own, so we would need to lay it over for any further consideration. So I will do that. We have a couple other bills we need to move on, but thank you very much for
thank you, Madam Chair.
A good presentation and a healthy discussion. Senator Bonhoeff, and I believe she would like to take number four first.
Right.
Senate File 848.
Good. A page?
Pardon? I need a page for some distribution here. This is for 848. We're going to take that bill first.
There, Mr. Members.
Senator Bonner, are you ready to go?
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here with Karen Bauma from the Board of Teaching. I'm actually introducing this bill on behalf of the Board of Teaching. This bill has been heard in the House and passed without opposition. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Bauma to talk about.
Thank you.
Ms. Bauma.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity. And Senator Bonoff, thank you for working with us on this bill. We think this is an important one, and you'll be pleased to know we think it's also a very technical, non-controversial bill. So you have before you just a brief handout. It's a portfolio at a glance with some numbers and data about this portfolio option that I'll speak to. I wanted to frame my comments for you first, though, with a very important fundamental understanding, and that is that licensure via portfolio is an, quote, alternative to licensure. However, it is fully separate from the dialogues and debates that you had a number of weeks ago relating to alternative routes to licensure. And herein lies the very core difference, and it's very important that the portfolio is an option available to individuals who believe they already have met by professional experience or other untraditional means that they've already met our licensing standards. So it's for individual people versus the portfolio, excuse me, the alternative routes bill that has now been enacted into law, which is about establishing licensing programs that will set up a way for to enroll individual candidates and move them towards licensure. So they're very different, and that's a fundamental understanding that I wanted to put forward. And with that in mind, what happened in 2004 when we first made this option available to individuals is we saw that this was popular and that our numbers started to grow pretty rapidly in terms of the number of people that thought that they could demonstrate our licensing competencies by this option. And so as the numbers grew, we quickly came to realize that that was unsustainable in terms of our support and infrastructure for it. The primary expense around this is that when we receive the portfolios that people put together, we send them out to content-specific reviewers, and we pay them a stipend for the many hours of time that they spend in reviewing those. So there were costs associated that we realized we were not going to be able to continue to maintain this option. So back in 2008, what we did is we came to the legislature and asked for two things. Number one, we asked for the authority to assess a fee, to charge a fee for these folks. It's a small fee. It's $300 for a first portfolio and $200 for any second portfolio, so that we could that we would have a fee associated with it. And then secondly, we asked the legislature and were given authority to capture that those fees in a special revenue account. Unlike our licensing fees, which all go to the general fund, and those don't come directly to us. We simply asked for the authority to take the fees that were generated by the portfolio applicants and use that money to sustain the option. And so that's what was established a couple of years ago. It was made clear to us at that time that it was not intended for staffing to hire people, but rather that the monies and the expenditures were to be for the costs associated with the option. So that's what we have done. We have primarily spent the money that is generated by the fees on those reviewers and then training, recalibrating those reviewers, workshops, and so forth. And so all that is before you today is the request to maintain this special revenue account that would, again, allow us to capture the fee generated by this option and use that money only for a step maintaining this option for individuals. So I certainly stand for any questions that you might have.
So are there any questions of Ms. Bauma? Is there anybody here from the department or somebody who could explain why this isn't in the governor's education budget or bill?
Do you know why it isn't? Madam Chair,
Ms. Bauma?
I don't know. I don't know that it was an intentional omission. I think that this was something we had talked about early in the cycle, which of course was prior to the change of administration, and I think perhaps this was in I don't know exactly where it was sort of lost, but I certainly would welcome them to share their perspective on that.
So Ms. Bauma, this amount is essentially money in that special revenue fund that has been generated by the fees of portfolio, and that authorizes you to expend it. and this would have to be done each biennium in order for you to have access to that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. As I understood, the initial legislative intent is that they want it, that they would build it in as a biennial request simply to make sure that we weren't sort of padding our bottom line and hiring people and using the money for other expenses. So this provides a layer of transparency for that.
Madam Chair, members, Christina Gossick, Minnesota Department of Education. This recommendation was in the governor's budget bill that you heard yesterday in one of the appropriations sections.
It was?
Yes, it was.
Oh. Sorry, we didn't. my assistant said that the language is different. Could you explain that?
Madam Chair, I don't have a response to that right now, but I can check with MMB staff and get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I apologize for misspeaking. Earlier.
Okay.
I didn't realize that it was in just a different form.
Okay. Are there any other questions that you have? If not, I would lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Very good. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Ballmer.
Thank you. You're welcome. Steve?
And Senator Bonoff, Senate File 489.
Yes, and there is a handout coming around, too. So sorry that wasn't in your package. Packet. Madam Chair, members, I'm here to present a renewed approach to shared services. And for those who have served with me before and those new to the committee, let me just give you a brief bit of history with regard to the shared services approach that I am advocating for. So it was 2 years ago I came forward with a shared services bill that required two things. 2 years ago I said that, number one, school districts must engage in cooperative purchasing. And then we had some exceptions. And then the second part of the bill said school districts must work with an outside consultant to determine the best and optimum use of shared services to achieve cost savings and increase quality. Well, I learned who was the boss in this arena, and the boss were the school districts. So they didn't like that approach, and we did not go forward. Last year, we actually did some work where we stepped back and we created a Commission on Service Innovation to explore what really is the proper way for our state to move forward with a redesign and a reengineering approach to all government services. And we created a very broad council, and many of you have heard that report, the Commission on Service Innovation's report. It was presented at One Minnesota, and it's also been presented, I believe, in the State Government and Reform Committee. One of the key components of the Commission on Service Innovation report was a shared services platform recommendation for whenever possible to begin exploring how we might in state government use a shared services platform to better deliver services at a lower cost and with greater efficiency. It really is the way the future is moving. Corporations have been doing this for years. You know, if you look at just a retail model, you know, what, for example, a big box retailer, be it Walmart, Best Buy, Target, they centralize many of their business functions, and then the retail stores have their other functions, but certainly don't perform most of the day-to-day business functions. So not only that, you have big corporations like Cargill and General Mills, which service customers worldwide, that have really taken this idea of shared services to the next level. And I've actually taken the time to go out and meet with executives at both Cargill and General Mills to understand exactly how they've approached that. And General Mills had a person who was on our commission for service innovation. So this approach in this bill takes it from a different perspective. It says that we do believe you ought to have a consultant with expertise, that if we just kind of fool around with this and we say, okay, you school districts all get together, that we're not going to get the maximum result, because there really are tried and true processes that works, and you don't need to reinvent everything from the beginning. And so the only mandate in this bill is for an that reminds me, and I apologize, I actually have an amendment, an author's amendment. And so I'd like to offer at this time the author's amendment, and that is the Ms. McQuay, what is it? The A1. So I'm offering the A1. And the reason why that's pertinent at this point in my testimony is because I am, instead of asking the Department of Education to take an action, I'm actually asking the Commissioner of Administration to take an action. And this amendment makes that change. So before we proceed, perhaps we should move the amendment.
Yes. Senator Bonoff moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 489. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you. So I'm now recommending that the Commissioner of Administration hire a consultant with experience in particularly shared services with regard to school districts. That's the only mandate in the bill. From that point on, it's really about marketing. It's about that consultant marketing his expertise and experience to the school district community at large and saying, hey, we think that you could have a lot more dollars in your classroom if you considered this, this, and this. But my experience shows me that school districts are reluctant perhaps to take that leap, and so we have put forward a contest in this bill to give school districts an incentive to participate with this consultant. The contest is Section 5, beginning on page 3.6, and what we've done here is said that the region of school districts that creates the most savings on a relative per pupil basis, that region and those districts participating are eligible to receive up to $500 per person with a cap of $5 million. So the idea being that's a pretty sizable incentive, and that then you'd get really many regions participating, and so only one region would get this, but we'd all get the payoff because they'd all be participating. There's two different payment issues in the bill. One is how do we pay for the consultant, and the way we pay for the consultant in the bill is the same way I proposed last time, which is a standard way business pays for consultants. You pay for it with a part of the savings, and you have to document it. You say you have this much money to start, and now you have this much more. School districts can keep 95% of the this much more, and up to 5% can be paid for the consultant's time. The second piece, how do we pay for the contest, has been more problematic. And originally, in my first version of the bill, I had intended to work with the Department of Education, work with various foundations to raise this money, and so I had listed it as a straight appropriation. Doing some exploration, have a different approach, and so in your amendment that we have approved, it says in fiscal years 2012, 2013, and 2014 only, the Commissioner of Administration has discretionary authority to increase the rate of the agency's internal services fund up to $5 million to pay for the cost of the grants. I got this idea from the former commissioner, Tom Hansen. He said that many of the agencies have their own internal services fund where they can use that fund to pay for things that they think will have long-term payoffs. That was a suggestion. In full disclosure, we haven't been able to reach the Commissioner of Administration, who's out sick today, and I hadn't realized I was going to be here today, and so I don't know for certain this will work, and so I'm suggesting that we adopt it with this. This would, because the Department of Administration is part of this, it would have to go to state government, and we could have a final verdict between now and then there.
Senator Weir.
Madam Chair, I think I did see a representative from the department, Representative Rhodes, right behind
yes,
you.
Yes, he's here. Yep, exactly.
They might be able to weigh in.
Yep, absolutely. And also, before we'll be done, I will ask for Steve Dahl, who's here, not only from Deloitte as a shared services expert, but also a member of the Commission on Service Innovation. But go ahead, Mr. Rhodes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and
Mr. Rhodes.
Senators. Jim Rhodes, Department of Administration. Senator Bonoff did call me earlier today, and I told her that their commissioner is home ill, but I talked to him. I got him out of bed, to tell you the truth. But we're not sure if this is going to work or not. And what, first of all, I should, for all disclosure, this is not our amendment and this is not our department bill, so just so you all know that. We always like to work with everybody. Department administration will certainly check into it. This is the first time I've seen it written out. She talked to me over the phone about it. And I'm a little nervous about the Internal Services Fund because that's going to get charged to somebody. There's not this magic fund out there that can't be touched. It goes to somebody. And whether it's all the other agencies that are going to pay for it in rent or whatever the case may be, which I don't know how that's going to play out either. So it's the committee's discretion of what you want to do with the amendment and what you want to do with the bill. But if it's in here, we'll work together and see what we can come up with. But I must caution you that we may come back and say it doesn't work and we need to have we have to be out of it then.
So, Mr. Rhodes, got some question about the Internal Services Fund. If every department has this Internal Services Fund, I don't think you ought to let Senator Perry know about it.
Madam Chair, I've been along here a long time. We know there's always looking for pots of money. But the key is, I guess, is that this would, if it's an Internal Service Fund, it's a little different than general fund appropriation, so it doesn't quite work that way. But I don't want to say anything to hurt Senator Bonoff's bill, and I want to be very clear that this is not a department thing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. There's others. I don't know if there's further questions, but there's a few folks here that would like to testify. Grace Kelleher, is she available? Sam Walseth, I believe somebody's standing in for Sam Walseth for the MREA.
Or Lee Warren and Sam would like to speak.
Lee Warren together, okay. And why don't you begin? You're there.
Well, call Steve Dahl first.
Pardon me?
Madam Chair, Steve Dahl.
Oh, I'm sorry. Certainly.
Oh, thank you. Steve Dahl from Deloitte Consulting here in Twin Cities, Minnesota. Have the privilege and pleasure to serve on the state's Commission on Service Innovation. And as Senator Bonoff, and I'm speaking in favor of this bill, and Senator Bonoff mentioned, in the Commission on Service Innovation, we really spent quite a bit of time looking at shared services consolidation, business process reengineering, lean, different efforts that are already happening to some degree within the state that we're really looking at how do we how can we incent the state and local governments to do more of that and further the efforts and the savings and the reform in government in those areas? And a couple of things that really came forward loud and clear in the Commission on Service Innovation, our discussion, were we really had some key barriers that we needed to help eliminate, which this bill does a lot to help address for school districts. And first was, we found a number of instances where people really wanted to move ahead with some type of an initiative, but they maybe lacked access to the expertise to be able to drive that forward. Other times it was a lacking of initial funding to be able to drive something forward, or a combination of both. So this bill really does a lot to kind of help address some of those issues to really provide the capability and some incentives for those districts to move forward with shared services and innovation. At Deloitte, we also do quite a bit of work in shared services, both public and private sectors have for many, many years, hundreds of different clients that we work with in this area. But probably most pertinent to share as it relates to this bill is we've been working with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania on a pilot project called Common Sense, which really is an initiative where 49 of the 501 districts within the Commonwealth are participating in a shared services initiative, and it's been pretty successful to date with an estimated $14 million in savings coming from that initiative. So there's ample evidence and proof that this type of initiative works and can work well if done properly and really drive some reform and savings across the state.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the committee members, Lee Warren with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. We have some interesting viewpoints about some of the impact that this bill might have. Rural districts have been doing cooperative purchasing forever. It's a way of life. It's survival. It's like raising a barn together. It's how we've always done things. We share superintendents. We share teachers. We purchase things together. What this bill describes is us. We've always done that. But what I think is really important for you to understand is the delicate relationship between school districts and their local business community, because this becomes an economic issue. When I was a school superintendent, I would find the cooperative purchasing, whatever group, the department administration, state bid, a service cooperative group, and I would, let's say it was tires, and I would go to a local dealer and say, I'd really like to buy your tires. Can you get close to this? And they would. They'd grumble a little bit, but, you know, they made a little money. I saved a lot of money, and I established a very necessary relationship. What's happened since I was a superintendent has become schools are dependent upon the local relationships for referendum levies. You have to have 92% or whatever districts have operating referendums. If you don't have that relationship, you can't pass an operating referendum. And here's a perfect example. A local a rural district decided they were going to do a bunch of purchasing together to save money. And they didn't buy fuel or bread, I don't remember which one it was, locally. And that particular business person said, you know what, I understand why you're trying to save money. And I was very polite about it and immediately dropped a ton of money into a no campaign and helped kill that referendum. I don't think we need to create the kinds of adversarial relationships when we absolutely, I think, need to have the cooperative relationships between our community. It's an economic issue in my mind. I applaud what Senator Bonhoeff is trying to do in terms of saving money, because we've got to survive and we've got to do the best job with the money that we've got available. But for rural schools, I believe we've done that for many years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Warren. Is there any questions? Got another testifier?
Madam Chair, my name is Kirk Schneider, and I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and trying to track down Senator during this time of the year is very hard, so we wish we would have had an opportunity to talk to her beforehand. But I think I appreciate her efforts in looking at the permissive nature of this piece, and I think that that's an important piece for locally elected school boards who are going through the process of flat funding, aid shifted, aid delayed, and they're doing a good job of trying to minimize any expenses that may have. And I think that I appreciate that piece. And there's some questions about this, whether it's required to hire the Department of Administration and what that means if we have to go through that or we're going to be required to go through the service co-op. So, and I also think that the important part is for us to consider is these current savings. We have already been going through that process. You know, we're sharing superintendents and principalships now. And so those are savings. We're sharing business officials. And so those are some of the things that need to be factored in as this moves forward. And we'll certainly work with the senator if she sees the need. So okay. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I just want to make sure that the Minnesota School Boards Association and MREA know there's no mandated purchasing. I'm staying far away from purchasing. I learned about those very sensitive relationships. And so I'm not saying that. And there's no requirement to work with the consultant.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question might be kind of along the line of your last two testifiers, Senator Bonhoeff. I'm wondering how this fits in with, I know we have the Southeast Service Cooperative, where we've already, I think, have a lot of this going on already, and I think there's maybe 30 school districts in Southeast Minnesota that are already a part of this. And I'm just wondering, can you differentiate between
Senator Nelson,
what's going on there?
They do an amazing job. And actually in the bill, they are recommended to work with their co-ops. What we've found, we actually took the time to survey every school district. We had TIES do that for us. They surveyed all the school districts in the state. And what we found is some school districts use their co-ops, some use them for this, some use them from that. But there isn't, we've never done a strategic, systematic, how could we best leverage all of it? And so it's just looking at it from new eyes. It may be that, you know, that is the one area that's probably done the most in this, so they may not choose to participate.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Your testimony? Yes,
yes.
Ma'am? Identify yourself for the record.
Yes, madam. I am Laura Larson. I'm representing the Minnesota Association of School Maintenance Supervisors. We had met with Senator Bonhoeff. She has listened to some of our concerns, but we still have some concerns. The bill as written doesn't specify which activities and services would be covered. And our concern is that it could move into the facilities area. And the problem with that is that in terms of saving money for 1 year, you can save money in facilities for 1 year, but you can pay for it double down the road. So, for example, if you need a roof on your house, you can put it off for a year, or you can put a patch or two on that roof, but you may end up paying three times what you would have if other parts of the roof fail. So in terms of the reward for those who participate, that's something that we're concerned about. Also, we are concerned that it could become a permanent way of operation for the schools, in which case our members from outstate have echoed some of the same concerns. I think that's all I have to say for now.
Thank you.
And just so the members know, Madam Chair, thank you. It is my belief that if we really looked at what was going to save us money, and it wouldn't end up being those areas, and research kind of proves that out. But I can understand that people are always nervous whenever you begin to look at some of these things. But we're really focusing on business processes here.
Thank you. There's another testifier.
My name is Craig Halbert. I work with Tremco Manufacturing, Madam Chair. I interface with the MASMIS organization, and I work with school districts and help them maintain their building envelope. And I would just agree that if there's any attempt to try to put together a one-size-fits-all for managing your bricks and mortar, I contend it's going to add cost to the process and not pull cost out. We need to reward people like Lori and people in that position to be creative and innovative in how they solve their problems. And you can do that by allowing them to interface with, shall I say, who they choose to. But if we restrict them to, let's say, two or three consultants in an area of expertise, all the revenue is just going to be being driven to some consultants, and you're not going to be finding any creative ways to pull cost out of managing the bricks and mortar of these facilities. And statewide, we're talking about billions of dollars.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? I will lay this bill over for further consideration. I think there's a number of issues that have been raised, but it's we will allow you to continue to work with this, and we still have time.
And Madam Chair, just a question with regard to that. If it turns out that this funding approach is possible and it has to go to state government, then could I come back and request a referral to state government?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoeff. The last bill on the agenda is House File 576. You noted that I made a comment earlier about the House talking about sending bills independently, and there haven't been too many of those. This one happened to arrive. It repeals going after the school district's fund balances for our state cash flow purposes. Several of you have introduced that bill. We have heard it, and it laid it over for possible inclusion. But there was no companion in the Senate to this particular file. The steps have been taken to give it a Senate author, and you'll notice who that is. And so if you would indulge me by allowing us to send this to the floor for a possible return to the House at some point. Would anybody be willing to move that?
Some.
Or if you have any questions. Senator Wigger moves. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is passed to the floor. Thank you very much. And I think that...
Madam Chair, could you set the stage, please, for next week?
Yes. Mr. Marcus, I'll let you introduce that.
Okay. Our tentative plan for next week is that on Monday we'll be able to look through a draft of the senator's omnibus bill as she's going to propose it, and then we will spend that Monday hearing reviewing the bill. On Tuesday, we'll have an opportunity to take testimony on the bill, and then on Wednesday, we'll begin the process of voting. And hopefully, our plan is to complete the voting on Wednesday. So we've got the rooms reserved for extra time if necessary. Hopefully, won't be too much extra time that'll be needed, but in case you'd like to take extra time, we do have the rooms reserved.
So the intent, finish by Wednesday evening, and that's where any...
Then it goes to finance.
Hopefully, we will be able to finish by Wednesday.
Okay. Thank you. Okay.
So, and I will be meeting with the caucuses to give some general review as well. So,
very good. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much for putting it in extra. We've gotten a lot of work done, and all of it is completed for today. So the meeting is adjourned.
Good.
Thank you.
Enjoy your weekend.
You might come in.